Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
ESNY. After the All-Star break, it's been work has been slow, and so have the Yankees.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. And what's happening, guys? This is Bleacher Creatures, episode 137, brought to you as always by Elite Sports NY, part of XL Media, Crossing Broad, War Gaming, and as always, Rivercrest NYC. How's it going, man? What's up, Alec?
It's going. Still don't have the new apartment fully unpacked, but it's much bigger and much more comfortable than the place I was originally at. So, you know, things are going.
I was going to say, because you're on your laptop, you were looking very comfortable.
That's like I am.
This is nice couch setup.
I'm joined by my dog, Reggie.
Oh, hey, buddy.
He's named giving after, me a look like.
Named after Reggie Jackson.
No, that was just his racing name.
Oh, nice.
But he's giving me a look right now like, why the hell are you talking right now?
This is my space.
Sorry, buddy.
Yeah. Anyway, so Yankees have Andrew Benintendi. Had a good walk-off win from Aaron Judge last night, but I think you and I both know, like, this team's kind of sluggish right now.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot of the issues that we were seeing last year are creeping back up. I'm like, there's the Gleyber Torres error earlier in the game where it's just like, yeah, that was something straight out of last year. And the offense has been kind of just bleh. And
kind of like they're going back to the bad habits of last year, I think, just because they're, I don't know whether it's fatigue carrying over from the All-Star break or just kind of like the dog days of August hitting early, but you can tell people are going up there. It's like, all right, let's find that one pitch and get on base. As opposed to taking a deep breath, refocusing.
Yeah. I was wondering that too, if it is just the dog days of August or what have you. But,
in defense of the players, like the last week or so in the city was ungodly hot.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
like I didn't leave my house for 2 days.
Oh, yeah. No, neither did I. Yeah. I mean, it was as equally hot here, if not maybe a little bit more. But there is a little bit of cause for concern. I mean, again, this shows the importance of that incredibly hot start they had because now they can afford this mini slump and still be in a really good position. But there is a little bit cause for concern because the level that they're playing at right now is just not good enough.
It's strange because I saw this on the Michael Kay show yesterday. Yes, posted this graphic. During this, I think they said it was a 5-15 stretch since a certain date. They've actually been scoring close to 6 runs a game. So the offense isn't the problem. The pitching, though, like we've said, they've been saying this on the broadcast. We've been saying this too. The innings count is starting to get to some guys. All of a sudden, like Gerrit Cole, like the bridge behind him isn't as sturdy. Michael Kay, Chad Green, they're both gone. Jonathan the Wise guy, he's back. We don't know what we can get from him. Miguel Castro is still a big loss. So the bullpen, I mean, this seems like a good time to talk about the Subway Series because first off, the Mets pulled the Astros playbook and treated these games with October urgency. Like this is a dry run for the postseason.
It would have been nice to see the Yankees play with that same kind of intensity.
Yeah.
And credit to the Mets. I mean, they're a good team. They played well. Scherzer was dominant. I wouldn't say Scherzer is dominant because the Yankees made some good contact against him, but he made the big pitch when he needed to. You know, Honestly, Yankee pitchers didn't pitch bad. Just the big difference was the Yankees couldn't score, couldn't get the big hit when there was a guy in scoring position. And it was just like, it was frustrating. And you know, that loss after Glaber hit the game tying home run in the eighth, like, again, that felt like a loss from last year, where it's just like, you know, some, I wasn't watching it, but I was following it on my phone. It was like some kind of bullshit thing when Peralta was pitching.
I don't know about you. I said the moment Clay Holmes pitched in the eighth inning, I like texted a Mets fan friend. I said, this game's over. Like, the Yankees just lost this game.
I think I saw it too, where it was like, wow, he's pitching in the eighth. Who the hell is going to pitch in the ninth? And
my best guess, like, I think I tweeted out, I said, are we so afraid of Pete Alonso leading off the eighth inning of a tie game that we're going to go to our closer? Like, John, like, because Loaisiga, he looked good in his, I think, the one batter he faced. Like, you can see, you can see, okay, there's still a little rust, but he's starting to get a feel for that sinker again. Peralta, who, as much as he craves high leverage situations, he's not a closer, not a ninth inning guy.
No.
He's a more reliable Dellin Betances in that way, where it's like, yeah, you can get some good high leverage innings out of him. You're not going to end, there'll be a clunker here and there, but under no circumstances, not the ninth inning.
Yeah, I agree. And I've been seeing kind of like rumblings on the Twitter sphere and whatnot, that which is also an example of how Boone got outmanaged by Buck. And I don't know, what did you think of that?
I mean, I think that, I don't know if it's that Boone got outmanaged by Buck. It's just that it's the experience factor. Buck, he walked to the Mets, who made several key additions this year, and then just walked in first day on the job, like, commands a room.
Mm-hmm.
And Boone, there's no doubt he has the respect of the Yankees to the point, and the players to the point, where he's going to be in the running for manager of the year again. But the way that Buck manages a team, that's a skill that only comes with time, and Boone hasn't had that yet. So so I'm not going to say that Buck outmanaged Boone, but it's clear that what the Mets have is something special, largely because of Buck Showalter.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I hate the Subway Series. What? I hate the whole pageantry that goes behind it. And, like, you know, you see it again on Twitter, where it's, you know, you got the Yankee fans and the Met fans going back and forth. It's just like,
it's not special anymore.
It really isn't. Like, and I don't know. I sit here and I hate the excuses. There's always going to be an excuse from this losing side when it comes to these games. For the Yankees, it was, oh, they pitched Montgomery and Herman and didn't have Stanton, and, you know, they just didn't really care about, like, the games as much as the Mets did. And it's like, well, of course the Mets are going to play with a little bit more of a fire under their ass. I mean, they've always been viewed as the little brother.
Exactly.
You know, of New York. But it's just like, you know,
New
York has two of the best teams in baseball. Like, enjoy the ride.
Yeah, like, I'm honestly more annoyed by Mets fans who don't post on social media about the Mets all year long, like, win or lose, that no matter how good or bad the team is, they just don't really post about the Mets. And then the Subway Series comes, they say, and then the Mets win a game, and then they go, oh, like, Yankees fans are silent now. I said to a guy, like, oh, like, you're a Mets fan? This is the first time you posted about the Mets all year. Congratulations. Now get the hell out of my office.
Yeah, it's just like,
keep my team's name out of your fucking mouth.
It's like, who cares about games in late July that literally mean nothing? It's like, it's not like the two teams are striving for the first over, like, you know, top position in the league or whatever. It's just like, okay, it's somewhat of a rivalry, which is not going to ever be the same unless they meet in the World Series. Like, it's kind of like what Jeter said last night in the episode. It's like, it's just the Mets.
Yeah.
And that's not an insult. It's just, they're just another team. Like, who cares?
I remember watching the very first Subway Series regular season game, and it being a big deal that the Mets, who were not a playoff team at that point, this is the pre-Piazza Mets, so these teams were terrible. And they pretty much shut down the Yankees in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And
what year would it happen?
97.
Okay, well, and then so let's think about also the significance then. You hit, the Yankees have guys like Strawberry and Cone, and was Doc on the team then? I can't remember.
Yeah, Doc was still on the team there. Yeah.
So, like, you know, for Mets fans, you're looking at your crosstown rival having three pretty key components to your last successful run.
I'm actually going to pull up the box score of that game. Why don't we do that before we talk about the captain? So 97 Yankees, that was the World Series hangover team, as we're all aware.
Yep.
All right, scheduling results, because I remember it was in July, and I think Dave Malicki was the winning pitcher for the Mets, and he had a quality start and then some. All right, find the Mets. Should have had this pulled up earlier. Sorry, folks.
I found it. It was June 16th, 1997.
Yeah, Dave Malicki versus Andy Pettit, and the Mets won 6-0.
Yeah.
And, oof, man, they scored three in the first inning. Yeah, so the Mets lineup that they had, Lance Johnson, Bernard Gilkey, John Olerud, Todd Hundley, Butch Husky, Carl Everett, Carlos Baerga, Matt Franco, and Luis Lopez. Butch Husky was the DH. And here's how the state of the Yankees were in 97. I guess everybody was hurt. Derek Jeter, Pat Kelly at second base, Paul O'Neill, Cecil Fielder, Tino, Charlie Hayes at third, Mark Witten, Chad Curtis, and Joe Girardi had a three-hit game, if you can believe that. And yeah, Dave Malicki scattered 9 hits through a complete game shutout, 119 pitches.
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad at all.
Yeah.
I love how Pettit still went 7 innings and gave up 5.
And oh God, but
at 103 pitches?
The Lord of the pickoff move in the first inning allowed Todd fucking Hundley to steal home on a double steal.
Oh, geez.
All right, we're going to put that away for now. Anyway, captain time. All right. Alex, so kicking things off, episodes 3 and 4 of The Captain aired last night. I don't know about you. I appreciated the seeds of the A-Rod drama being planted. Mm-hmm. But other than that, like, I was kind of underwhelmed. Like, okay, cool. Michael Jordan cameo shows up. Oh, yeah, I respect Derek Jeter because he inspires his team. Okay, but
yeah.
Other than that, it wasn't anything we didn't know already.
Yeah. It was a series of episodes where I asked myself, would this have been better if it didn't just focus on Jeter, if it focused on the core four and just the dynasty, you know? Because yeah. I found, like, because, like, these episodes, until I got into the Jeter or A-Rod situation, it seemed more focused on the team as a whole, you know? It seemed more focused on the dynasty and what the dynasty meant. And I thought that would have been, like, I would love to go more into that and into just that team in general. I mean, I think listening to Strawberry or Pettit and Posada, I think it's a travesty they didn't get Paul O'Neill on there. But
remind me, have you seen Last Dance in its entirety?
No, I have not.
Well, the beauty of The Last Dance is that on top of being all about Jordan, it talks about the Bulls dynasty. And then so you learn about Scottie Pippen's backstory. You learn about Dennis Rodman's backstory. You learn about Phil Jackson's backstory. You learn just what made everyone on that team go. Now, granted, baseball, it has the best stories on the field, but off the field, the good ones are few and far between. So maybe it's just that, okay, Posada and Bernie Williams, they come up from Puerto Rico. Mariano Rivera, but Rivera's whole story about living in this remote fishing village in Panama. That's a great story you want to learn. So yeah, we know the story about what happened in the seasons. Tell us more behind the scenes stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like it didn't really just go into Jeter himself. And I think this is a very specific or like specialized documentary that people in New York would love.
Yeah.
But the casual fan might not. Like, that makes sense. Like, it seems more about the legacy of the Yankees than it did about Jeter, at least in these two episodes.
Right. Well, the good news, though, is that because you, episode three, you start with Scott Robb and the Esquire article. And then we'll get to that in a second. And then at the end of the next episode, okay, Jeter and A-Rod are teammates now. So you have to figure that we're going to get – we saw some sites of not so much Derek Jeter the athlete, but Derek Jeter the superstar in this episode, sort of like the public figure going out and giving himself a hernia on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
But I think that next time we're going to see, okay, you have two high-profile guys on the same team, very much in the public eye off the field, and this is where you're going to get into maybe the women or the A-Rod drama and like you might remember this even down in Florida. In 07, the Yankees were in Toronto, and the New York Post snapped a picture of A-Rod in the lobby of the team hotel with a very good-looking blonde woman who was not his wife.
I do vaguely remember that. I remember how much of a big deal that was. Yeah. And especially because, like, now we're, like, I feel like we're venturing. Well, we still got to get through the whole 04 situation.
I have a feeling that we'll kick off. Because next week's a double episode too. I figure next week they'll kick off with choking in 04.
Yeah. But then it's going to be like entering kind of the dark ages for the Yankees.
Well,
like,
yeah, that's where all the A-Rod drama comes to life. What? My apartment buzzer just went off.
No guests at this hour, please.
Yeah. And I probably delivered.
Well, like a thing I thought was really cool, and I wish they probably would have gone more into, which, like, I would have loved to hear more about that rivalry with the Sox, but like maybe, again, the issue where it's called the captain, and it's not about the dynasty or the team itself, but like, you know, I would have loved a little bit more exploration into that era where A-Rod, Jeter, and Nomar were like the three biggest figures in the sport, or just like, you know, I wouldn't mind hearing, you know, what Nomar thought about that series, or what Pedro thought.
How much of a dork is Nomar, by the way?
He's a little mousy dude.
But just like the way he talks, he's like almost like very Midwestern and like super sincere. He's like really trying to, he's almost trying too hard to have his moment in the series instead of just talking.
Yeah.
Dude, your life is more than just being married to Mia Hamm. Stop trying so hard.
Oh, that's right. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of feel bad for him because, like, he was overshadowed by the two other guys, but, like, he put up some numbers flew way under the radar.
Yeah, didn't he win, like, two, maybe three batting titles in those prime years? He won at least
I'll
one.
Pull it up right now.
Because I remember
he won Rookie of the Year in 97. And he's a two-time batting title champ, where in consecutive years he hit .357 and then .372.
In the .372 year, didn't he also have like close to 40 homers?
No, he only had 21 that year. He had 35 home runs in 98, where he came second in MVP.
Yeah, and then a lot of fans may or may not recall, and I think it was the 2001 season, Nomar had this wrist injury. It was like I remember reading it was an issue with one of his tendon sheaths, not so much the tendon, and just and then he wound up having surgery, missed the rest of the season, was never the same.
In 2001 he played 21 games. He had a good bounce back year in 2002. He hit .310 with 56 doubles and 120 RBIs.
Yeah, but like aside from that, like he started then kind of declining pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, I'm like he just kept getting hurt. I mean, he had two 02 and 03 were the last years where he played pretty much a full season. He played 156 games.
This is something I want to see. I want to see next week, because they focused on the last thing they did was that July game where he busted his face. Jeter did.
Yeah.
People will also recall Nomar was traded to the Cubs not long after that. I think it was maybe 2 weeks.
And really?
Yeah, you got to wonder how salty is Nomar that he missed out on winning a World Series with the Red Sox that
year. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, it's so funny when you think about guys' legacy, and it's those little instances. Like, what would his legacy have been if Nomar had been the shortstop that won the World Series with the Sox, or at the very beginning of the series, how much better would have Don Mattingly's legacy been if he had just stayed and played one more year?
Yeah. Yeah. And that, going back to the Red Sox with the 99 series, something they forgot to mention in the documentary, the Red Sox kind of dominated the Yankees that regular season. I think they won the season series 8-4, something like that.
So. And that's where I think the series plays to the strengths, is when they're talking about like those teams, and when Jeter just mentions the state of those teams on how they just knew how to win.
Well, you know how to win, but what is it? Does Derek Jeter's natural leadership just have that much of a trickle-down effect? Like, how does this guy rally the troops? Because he's this very stoic guy, kind of like, as John Jastrzemski says on his New York podcast, kind of almost like a Michael Corleone type. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. But so how does someone who keeps that small circle, doesn't really talk to the media that much, and kind of like really knows how to play the game, how does he rally like 25 guys plus a coaching staff?
Well, I wonder if that's where A-Rod's comments hold a little bit of truth, you know, because like you look at the players that Jeter was surrounded by, and they were guys who knew how to win. I mean, you know, you had Coney, you had O'Neill, you had Strawberry, like you had guys who had been there and been successful.
You could argue that he learned from a good group. Would they already covered in the documentary, he learned from Strawberry. Hey, like, don't go too crazy with the nightlife. Like, look at the mistakes it can lead to. He probably learned how to learn from Coney. Okay, here's how, when things are intense, here's how you maintain laser focus. And then with Paul O'Neill, it's like, no, it's okay to feel mad after every damn loss. It's okay to feel mad if you get out. Like, it's like, and then Jeter kind of takes it all together, learns how to stay himself, not kind of get caught up in the whole clubhouse brouhaha. And then in doing so, he kind of finds his people, like namely Posada. Like, they also, he and Posada were best friends. I'm kind of surprised they haven't touched on that friendship so much.
Yeah. Again, it does seem like the series does not quite know what direction it wants to go in. Because like those first two were very Jeter centric, which is awesome. Like, you love to hear like these little things that he like experienced that he's not open about. Like what was he saying yesterday? He had
how all of a sudden like a friend of his who he from high school or from Michigan who he thought he had been close with, like it turns out says, oh, like I'm not into interracial marriages.
Yeah,
but you've been to my house. You know my parents.
Yeah, like there's
just how like he got famous. He got famous in people's true colors, so all of a sudden came out.
Yeah, but then like also like I would love to hear more about the dynamic that he had with the team itself. Like I thought that was really interesting. Like imagining Derek Jeter getting into a shouting match with George Steinbrenner
or David Wells.
Like, I would love, I don't know, I guess maybe more of the baseball historian in me wants to sit there and be like, no, go into that more. Tell me about like the clubhouse dynamic. Like, how did you guys do all this and like, you know, keep a level head?
I mean, it's, especially when they focused on the 2000 series and the Yankees just, oh man, I remember watching that series or watching that season and like the last month of it. It was so frustrating. It's like they found different ways how to lose every night.
Yeah.
And And then all of a sudden in the playoffs, oh, all of a sudden they're back. Okay, all so it takes Eric Chavez talking shit in a press conference to rally the team to victory. Oh, okay, but what else is really going on? What's like, what's everyone's attitude after the game? After 2001, yeah. Jeter's apparently fuming in the locker room.
Yeah.
Okay, like I want to hear what's Derek Jeter really like when he's mad?
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was also really interesting that he like was standing out there at shortstop in the eighth innings, like, oh yeah, we're gonna win the World Series. That seemed very unlike him. And all right, like that was a cool moment of where we got to like see a side of him that no one is probably really familiar with, you know?
Yeah. I mean, either way, just the A-Rod drama alone. Oh God, can we talk about Scott Robb for a second?
He's such a piece of shit.
I mean, like, first off, the ponytail. That's the first warning sign right there.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, dude, the weird, like, I get it. It's a cutthroat industry when you got to try to get your, you know, your, I don't even know what the word I'm looking for is.
You want to get your,
but like, yeah, yeah. And like, but like, he went behind that one dude and he was talking to Scott Boras, like that audio. And it's just like,
yeah,
dude, that's just sleazeball. Like, and what was that ending quote he had? It was just like, oh yeah, it had no bearing on me whatsoever. Like, I didn't give a shit.
Look, I get it. I get that when under those circumstances, especially when you don't really have social media to piggyback off of, and you really got to get out when you really are forced to 100% get out in the field. Like, not to say it's like less, it's that much less than 100% now. Like, all the people out on the beat right now and getting those good quotes. I mean, right now, I think I'll do a great time to shout out Lindsay Adler at The Athletic for this piece she had on Joey Gallo today, which we can talk about in a second. But back then, like, in like, it's the internet age, but it's not quite the social media age yet. Just being able to get a meeting with A-Rod and Scott Boras, let alone at a courtside at a Miami Heat game after a record-setting contract, that's a big deal for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, okay, you can talk about growing up in Florida, going from Seattle to Texas, two very different teams at the time, and talk about the contract and the pressure with it, but rather, okay, what does this contract mean for the A-Rod Jeter Nomar dynamic?
Yeah.
Because Jeter got paid too, but not as much as A-Rod, which
I think didn't Nomar get paid too?
I don't remember the terms of Nomar's contract, but I remember Jeter's extension was I think 10 years for $189 million.
Isn't it funny also when we're watching that? It's just like A-Rod signs for 10 years, $252 million. It's like imagine if you could sign the best player in baseball to a contract like that. Like imagine if Juan Soto got a contract like that. 10 years, $252 million. That's nothing now. And that changed in a matter of a decade.
Do you remember where you were by chance when the A-Rod contract got announced?
I do not. Well, because what? That was at the end of the – that was the offseason between – yeah.
Yeah, so pre-01.
I'm gonna age myself here. I was 6 years old, seven.
Yeah, you were probably training.
No. Like I remember seeing him in the Texas jersey and being like, yeah, it did. Like the number three, and just remember like how big he was.
And Texas, speaking of big, how were you blown away by how big Roger Clemens was last night?
Yeah,
he's
blown up. Yeah, he's blown up, but he's a beast. God.
Yeah.
Like, give us more of the Clemens and Piazza thing.
Yeah. I mean,
like,
there's not much to talk about in terms of that, I think, because, okay, so Roger Clemens and Pedro Martinez are one and the same. They're headhunters. The difference is Martinez is this little 5'10 spindly dude. Roger Clemens is 6'5" and will destroy you.
Yes.
So, but I definitely want to think more about, or wanted to hear more about how Jeter didn't really like Clemens for pitching up and in on him, but then all of a sudden he shows up, he's part of the team, makes him feel comfortable. What about, like, did they talk at all? Was there anything else? Did they hash anything out?
Yeah.
Maybe Jeter's just very what happens in the clubhouse stays in the clubhouse. But
yeah,
but going back to the A-Rod contract, I remember just reading what his demands were. He wanted like a 12-year deal. He wanted a private jet. He wanted several luxury boxes for his family. He wanted an actual office at the new home ballpark. And it just seemed ridiculous. And I remember being in high school. This would have been during ninth grade study hall. And my high school had something where if you were on honor roll or something, you didn't have to report to a study hall. It was essentially a free period for you.
Right.
So not to toot my own horn, I'm in the computer lab just kind of messing around. A few other kids like rush in at something. They're like, Benjamin, go to ESPN. I'm like, oh, okay. ESPN, breaking news, Alex Rodriguez, 10 years, $252 million with the Rangers. And I remember, like, we look at it, and then me and one kid both just kind of looked at each other and just went, but the Rangers suck. And they were terrible.
Yeah.
Those were the Buck Showalter Rangers. They were so bad. I think they averaged, 90 losses a year.
Isn't it kind of funny how history repeats itself?
Where sense.
An underachieving Texas team goes out and signs a big time star and still don't really achieve much. And then go to this offseason and the underachieving Texas Rangers acquire multiple big time stars and they are still kind of just whatever.
it's really sad because if you look at what the Rangers have done in the or had done with all that luxury tax money in the years preceding John Gray, Corey Seager, and Marcus Semien, the $500 million all-star team, right?
Yeah.
They were clearly taking that money. They were putting it into player development. They were putting it into analytics. They were revamping their scouting department. They were trying to get more, they're trying to modernize themselves as an organization post Nolan Ryan. And it just shows that, hey, no matter, you can do everything right in this sport and still lose.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes more than others.
Yeah. It's an unforgiving sport.
Yeah.
Like it really is. So.
But anyway, so shifting back to the captain. Oh, so here's I need your perspective on this because you're a former catcher. Just we'll call it like the footwork gymnastics that Posada was doing on the flip play.
Now that was cool. That was awesome. Like, you know,
that's like true inside baseball.
Yes. And I noticed it too, like a split second before there's the angle where it was from the outfield. And I noticed it right before Jorge said something. And I was like, wow, he was going out to get that ball and he had to, adjust his feet. I mean, it's great awareness on his part. Like he just knowing where you are, knowing where the plate is. And he still had like a good amount of it covered. That stuff was cool. Just watching Jeter make that read, watching Jorge readjust and just blindly tag. And Jorge is completely right. If Giambi slides, he's safe.
Yeah, that's one of those plays where you'd want to kind of have it simulated through StatCast to figure out the out probability on it.
Yeah, right.
It's got to be if it's more than 1%. It's 0%.
I think it was like midway through the first episode yesterday. My girlfriend joined me and we were watching it together. And then as we're going to bed, I was like, now you understand why Yankee fans are kind of the way they are.
Yeah.
Like that just kind of like, she's a Phillies fan. And so I always give her shit for that. But like kind of that expecting something great to happen or to just execute, you know, and you just kind of watch that. And then she was there, she was watching the 0-1 series.
Oh,
God. And watched the game-winning hit by Luis Gonzalez. And she goes, yeah, that sucks. Like, that's not even on – I wasn't aware because I kind of, like, tuned anything regarding that series out, or at least Game 7 out. Yeah. I did not know that Scott Brosius could have thrown the first for the double play.
Neither did I. That, I saw the play, and I'm just going like, what?
Yeah, I was like, oh no.
How am I only just getting this memo?
Yeah. But then and my girlfriend's just like, yeah, once that hit fell in for Gonzalez, she goes, yeah, I don't even blame Mariano on that. That's yeah. Like, yeah.
It's so, yeah, that was terrible. But oh man, I hated that series so much.
I messaged you this last night, but imagine the city if they had won
in 2001. Yeah, I mean, Canyon of Heroes, you probably I don't mean to get all morbid with this, but like there might have been like a severe over, because I went to the 2009 parade and it was crowded, but you could like you could get around if you knew what you were doing. 2001, it would have been like Astro Ball or whatever with that Travis Scott thing, and it would have been. So like, I don't mean to get more, but that would have been a disaster. 2001.
I feel for that city being so close to like, you know.
That's kind of why that loss really stung. Like New York felt robbed.
Yeah.
Like Arizona straight robbed us. And also just like just Bush hanging out and like and messing with Derek on the side. Like,
oh yeah. That story I knew.
I did not know that story. I thought that was really sweet.
Yeah. No, I think Jeter has written about it in his like biography. But yeah, it was like, and credit to Bush. I mean, that dude threw a strike. Like he zipped that in there.
I mean, so. his father was played college ball at Yale and was pretty good from what I imagine or from what I've heard.
Wasn't he part owner of the Rangers?
Bush Jr. was, yes. Yeah, and
Bush Jr. was, okay.
Yeah, and he was like he was part of like a group of owners and he was just kind of the face of it because of who his dad was at the time. But I think there's
a famous picture of George, like the father, meeting someone when he was a baseball player at Yale.
I know exactly which picture you're talking about.
He met Babe Ruth.
And he's in uniform. Bush is.
Yes.
Yep. Know exactly which picture you're talking about. Anyway. What else did we miss anything from these episodes? Not really. But
no, I mean
the 03 Red Sox series, that was fun to touch on, but it was filler by that point.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I mean, Derek Jeter has a never say die attitude that makes him born to be a Yankee and just kind of trickles down to the rest of the team. He learns from guys like O'Neill, like Strawberry. And now I think we're really going to see just what kind of clubhouse he ran, especially with A-Rod in tow.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said earlier, I'm like, we're kind of going to be entering the dark ages of Yankee baseball.
And, like, yeah. There's going
to
be
which is funny to say because you look back and there are several teams in Major League Baseball who would kill to have a decade that the Yankees had starting at 04. You know, it's just – you know, at the end of it, nothing really good was happening for the Yankees because you had that expectation they're going to win every year and they don't. And then you get aging players and then you get this weird, you know, drama that kind of seems to, you know, seep into every crack and cranny of that clubhouse. And,
well, a lot of that also has to do with the fact that at this point, Brian Cashman, he's essentially general manager in name only with a few exceptions because after 2000, after 2001, Steinbrenner kind of wrests control and goes and signs Jason Giambi.
Yeah.
Which in retrospect wasn't that bad of a move because Nick Johnson wasn't ready at that point and wasn't much of a first baseman.
And when I saw Nick Johnson on the TV, I made an audible noise of disgust.
So Nick Johnson triggers you too?
Yes. When I think about those quote unquote dark ages, he's one of the faces that pop up and it pisses me off to no end.
I've looked at his minor league numbers and okay, he was a decent enough like contact hitter, But then I look at his minor numbers, look what he did as a pro, and I just think, I'm sorry, what did the Yankees see in this guy?
Yeah. Yeah, and so I'm looking at Jason Giambi's numbers when he was a Yankee. And do you remember there being some criticism behind him, like, as the deal kind of wore on about?
Yeah, because I remember his first year with the team, he made the cover of Sports Illustrated, and naturally, because of the jinx, got off to a slump, found a stroke, and then around 04, because that's when he had the steroids caught up with him, and he had that that tumor on his pituitary gland. Mm-hmm. I remember there being some criticism as the deal wore on, but it was mostly just because, okay, like, he's getting older and he doesn't have the steroids anymore. Like, even if whether or not they were actually doing anything, he wasn't the same player.
But you know what's funny? Like, I think it's because we have a better understanding on how to read analytics and graphs.
Yeah.
Like, you know, yeah, in 2002, he had a great year, 41 home runs, 122 RBIs, an OPS of over 1,000.
Yeah.
But you go to even his last year as a Yankee, his age 37 season in 08, he still had an OPS of 876, and only twice did he have an OPS under 800 as a Yankee, and those were both injury-shortened seasons. When he played full seasons, he had an OPS well over 900.
I think a lot of it also has to do with the fact that when at the time that the Yankees signed Giambi, he kind of had gained a rep as a Yankee killer, especially in the playoffs. So here I'm actually pulling up his career batting split, see what he's hit for his career against the Yankees. Because I think they saw, like, okay, this is a guy who's destroyed us before. Now he's playing with us, so now he's going to destroy all the other teams. And aside for those couple of years, he wasn't video game good, as I like to say. So right. It's funny because against the Yankees for his career, he was only about a 250 hitter, like 248, OPS of 737. Only 7 home runs in the regular season with the Yankees. He had more career home runs against the A's than he did the Yankees.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like the whole Garrett Cole thing. I interviewed John Jastrzemski, or JJ, as we all call him, right before the start of the season. I said, like, what we've talked about in our chats, I'm like, hey, like, what is it about Yankees fans that they're taking these last few years and not making the World Series so personally? And much like Giambi was back then, he said, look, I think people saw Garrett Cole as getting them over the top. It hasn't happened yet, and it's a combination of disappointment and impatience.
Yeah.
And Jason Giambi was very much the same thing, because I remember watching that 2002 ALDS. I didn't think the Angels were that good. It's like, okay, the Angels beat us in the season series, but yeah, it's the playoffs, so we're the Yankees. We'll find a way to beat them, and we kind of took the Angels for granted. Look what happened.
Yeah, I mean, let's see.
What stats are you deep into now?
I'm looking at that division series. I mean, they're all decently close games. I mean,
yeah, but game
Yankees three. Win game one, 8-5. They lose game two, 8-6. Game three, they lose 9-6. And they lose game four, 9-5. Pitching was a mess.
And the problem was game three, they had like a pretty big lead most of the game, and it just evaporated.
Yeah. So let's see who hit well. Giambi hit well. Giambi hit 357.
Yeah.
Jeter hit 500.
I think Bernie Williams hit pretty well too.
Didn't Bernie have like a big home run that year?
In game one of 02, he had a big home run, yeah.
He hit 333. Yeah, other than that, no one really hit well. I mean, you know, these are the days we're running out Raul Mondesi and
what
who else?
He was a
Juan Rivera.
Yeah, the dark ages of the outfield.
Robin Ventura. Oh God. Alfonso Soriano did not have a good playoffs. He hit 118 that year.
Wow, this was an old team.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, it should be fun next week though, because like I said, we're probably gonna get more A-Rod, more tabloid stuff. Maybe they'll get they'll close with the 09 series.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, I want to see more about the team, not so much about Derek Jeter. I want to see yeah. like the comparable limelights between him and A-Rod when they're teammates. I want to see how A-Rod's whole like drama and having a different celebrity girlfriend every year affected the clubhouse dynamic. There's that story about in the playoffs where A-Rod like signs a baseball with his number, gives it to a fan in the stands in the middle of a losing playoff game, and that pissed Jeter
off. Yeah, I do remember. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I can feel like we're entering a part where we know a lot of stuff already, because social media starts becoming a little bit bigger. ESPN's coverage starts becoming a little bit more like widespread when it comes to, you know, the Yankees.
We're getting to the point where it's like, yeah, we know all this. Show us what was really going on.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I feel. So, we'll see. I'm like, I'm still going to watch for sure.
If the weather holds up, I'll be watching Garrett Cole at the Yankee game tonight.
There you go. Are you going to the Paul O'Neill game? Have you gotten tickets shot yet?
What date is that again?
That's August 21st or 22nd. It's a Sunday against the Blue Jays.
I'm getting back from the Jersey Shore the day before. I will, if I can swing, and we're supposed to hang out with a couple that night. If we can hang out with them at night, then I can go to the Paul O'Neill game.
Gotcha.
All right.
Well, but I'll be there. So.
Yeah, Paul O'Neill will not be there.
I know. Oh, God.
Yeah, I hate it.
He's like ruining his own, goddamn.
I think that's why they're not playing the old timers game again on Saturday either. Maybe all the guys who can still play just aren't vaccinated.
Yeah.
Probably. Weird end of the show today, folks. Anyway, thanks for listening to Bleacher Creatures.
Well, speaking of unvaccinated, Andrew Benintendi is a Yankee. There you go.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll close with this. Close on a positive note. I love this trade. I love the Benintendi trade. It's great. The Yankees love their nice Italian boys, don't they?
Oh, yes. The gabagools. What can you say?
Joey Gallo, I wanted to touch on this article from Lindsay Adler in The Athletic too. He knows he's on his way out. He knows it's like it's done. But he's really just been like, hey, like I came here to play as a Yankee. I didn't play well. Like that's all. Yeah. I wasn't good enough.
I feel bad for him. You know, he seems like a good dude and everything, but
I'm sure he's
one
great.
Thing that kind of just annoys me is, remember that comment he said, like, this is who I am as a hitter. It's like, yeah, but it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't. So no, it doesn't.
Look at Matt Carpenter changed his swing, and he's had a good, like, how long has he been on the team? 2 months?
Yeah.
Like he's had a good 2 months, and if that was it, that'd be, like, some players in the league would say, hey, I would love to have an entire season like that. Does that make sense? Like,
no, it like does.
14 home runs and 100 games.
He's a home run. It's like Shane Spencer effectiveness almost, circa 1998. Joey Gallo, I don't know, like $1 million bat, 10-cent head. Is that it? I don't know.
Maybe.
It's a shame. Like he seems like a perfectly nice guy. I'm sorry it didn't work out with the Yankees. Like I had a great season with him in MLB The Show, but it's like, okay, like enough's enough. And they could have gotten Benintendi. They could have gotten literally anybody to play outfield, and it would have been an improvement over Joey Gallo in the lineup.
Yep, I agree.
All right, well, thanks for listening, folks. You can find me on Twitter at JoshBESNY, Alex at Alec_MonteCalvo.
Correct.
All right. Does Reggie have anything to add, or is he off the couch?
No, he's still here. He switched positions, so he's facing me now. He's got his paw digging into my leg, probably telling me to shut the hell up. he sleeps 18 hours a day. And apparently, sounds that's like not enough for him.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week.